Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader, who condemns President Obama's drone warfare program for violation of U.S. and international law. Sarah Anderson of the Institute for Policy Studies, who discusses her group's new report that reveals corporate CEOs advocating austerity policies received millions of dollars in taxpayer-subsidized stock options. And Professor of Political Economy, Gar Alperovitz, who examines innovative, democratic, and sustainable alternatives to America's current failing economic system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
During his May Day speech, Bolivian President Evo Morales announced the expulsion of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, from his nation for what he said was an attempt to influence local leaders through its programs. Morales also criticized U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry for referring to Latin America as the United States' backyard. The announcement, which effectively ends U.S. assistance to Bolivia's health, education, and environmental programs, came only days after a Bolivian court upheld Morales' right to seek an unprecedented third term as president. Some observers viewed Morales' announcement as a kickoff for his new presidential campaign. In 2008, Bolivia expelled then-U.S. Ambassador Philip Goldberg and officials from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration for targeting coca farmers as drug traffickers. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the feud between Morales, who previously led the Coca Farmers Union, and Washington dates back to the USAID's drug eradication campaigns, which ignited violence in many villages. Catherine Lederber of the Andean Information Network observed, "The long-standing mistrust was exacerbated after Morales' election when the Bolivian government accused USAID of working with opposition groups to undermine his administration." The April 23rd bombing of the French embassy in Tripoli, Libya, set off alarm bells as Islamic militants go on the offensive in northern Africa. In January, French troops were deployed to Mali, where they attacked Islamic fighters. A Western diplomat in Libya told the Guardian newspaper, "There are established links between groups in Mali and Libya. There is anxiety among the political class here that Mali is blowing back on them." The insurgency in Mali was energized by two different armed factions, ethnic Tuareg soldiers who were hired to defend overthrown Libyan strongman Muammar Gaddafi's regime, and militants affiliated with Al-Qaeda. Now that the French have retaken cities in northern Mali, the insurgents are on the run across the Sahara. Libya's second-largest city, Benghazi, has become especially dangerous for Western diplomats. Last September, U.S. Ambassador to Libya Chris Stevens was killed in an attack on the American consulate in that city. More recently, similar assaults have been carried out against the Italian, British, and Tunisian consulates, as well as Egyptian Coptic churches and oil pipelines. Grand Forks, North Dakota Deputy Sheriff Alan Frazier was looking for an affordable alternative to a $25 million turbo-powered helicopter. He came across an unmanned aerial vehicle, or drone, which was about the same price as a high-end police cruiser. Yet drones are still rare among local law enforcement agencies, and citizen resistance is building to domestic drones as activists raise possible violations of privacy rights. The Obama administration is moving to put more domestic drones into use, while the Federal Aviation Administration is preparing to open up U.S. airspace for drones. According to the Christian Science Monitor, the U.S. Border Patrol is the government agency that uses the largest number of drones, mostly for domestic surveillance of the Rio Grande border region, searching for undocumented immigrants and drug smugglers. Domestic drones are usually equipped with night vision technology and high-powered cameras that can read license plates. In Seattle, community activists blocked the city from launching a law enforcement drone program, concerned that unmanned aircraft would become flying government robots watching citizens' every move. In Charlotte, Virginia, the city passed the first no-drone resolution, placing a 2-year ban on police use of drone technology. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Since President Obama took office in 2009, it's estimated that the U.S. drone program has killed more than 3,000 people in counter-terrorist strikes in Pakistan, Yemen, and Somalia, all ordered without due process or judicial oversight. On April 27th, the Yale Law School presented a panel discussion titled Thinking About Drone Warfare. The event featured four guest speakers from academia, human rights groups, law, and public policy organizations. Panelists discussed the constitutionality of drone warfare from varying perspectives, most concluding that whether under President George W. Bush or President Barack Obama, the secretive extrajudicial killing of anyone deemed to be a terrorist, and even more so the killing of totally innocent people in the process, is both legally and morally wrong. Sitting in the audience was Ralph Nader, a graduate of Harvard Law School, who excoriated his alma mater for not adopting a more critical attitude toward the use of drones and for failing to condemn the practice. He said he feared the only thing that would move most legal scholars to take a position was a drone strike on a convention of constitutional lawyers. In an April 14th commentary, Nader wrote, quote, "The 2001 congressional authorization to use military force is not an open-ended authorization for the president. It was restricted to targeting only nations, organizations, or persons that are determined to have been implicated in the 9/11 massacres or harbored complicit organizations or persons. Unless the American people come to realize that a president must be subject to the rule of law and our Constitution, our statutes and treaties, every succeeding president will push the deficit finance lawlessness further until the inevitable blowback day of reckoning. That is the fate of all empires," Nader wrote. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Ralph Nader after the Yale Forum, where he placed drone strikes in the context of other post-9/11 attacks on human rights and civil liberties.
Well, it's in the matrix of massive recurrent violations by presidents now, Bush and Obama, of our Constitution, international treaties, and federal statutes. And we've all read the reports about secret laws, secret prisons, secret courts, indefinite imprisonment, torture, wars of criminal aggression against countries that don't threaten us, and illegal surveillance. And those are just the beginnings. And out of that comes the sense by President Bush and President Obama that they can send these drones anywhere in the world, violate any national sovereignties, all in secret, and that the president is the prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner of whoever the president, in his secret, uncontrolled judgment, thinks is either a suspect or someone whose free speech the president despises. And so, as a result, thousands of innocent people have been killed. The drones have targeted actual housing compounds, funeral processions, wedding parties. Once there were 12 schoolboys collecting wood for the family. They were vaporized on a hillside. It's just continually to spread without any kind of accountability to Congress or to the courts or informing the American people in whose name all this violence is occurring. So the payback is going to be what the CIA has called blowback. It's going to come back to this country, whether in the form of external attacks or internal attacks, because the feeling of injustice and the grievances of these people overseas. Imagine living under 24/7 whining drones ready to strike. Imagine the millions of people have to endure that is going to come back and seriously damage our national security.
So there was a gentleman toward the end, the older gentleman, who was saying, you know, he still supported Obama and he felt like he was kind of being forced into it. Because I wasn't sure what he was saying. I guess that maybe this, you know, post 9/11 security state would demand this. What do you think about Obama's motivation, or, you know, do you feel like he's sort of been boxed into this, or this is something he's totally, you know, embraced?
Not at all. No, and he knows better. He's a constitutional law lecturer to begin with.
You got to watch out for those constitutional lawyers.
That's right. No, he has expanded Bush's outrages in every area except possibly torture. More drones, more invasions and incursions in other countries, huge secrecy. He's prosecuting whistleblowers in his own administration in ways that no other president has, invoking the Espionage Act of 1917. No, he's his own man, and he's decided to be presiding over the American empire and avoiding the rule of law.
What I think is interesting is a lot of people got very upset when Bush did a lot of things that people considered illegal and unconstitutional. There's been very little, certainly nothing on the scale of opposition when Bush did a bunch of different things. And, I mean, obviously this conference is one example of people who are, you know, taking up this issue. And there have been people, but it hasn't been like this broad-based outcry or opposition. Why do you think that is?
Because liberals operate under the least worst political decision-making. And they will forgive any Democratic Party outrage as long as they think the Republicans are worse. So, for example, they criticized Bush for freezing the minimum wage for years, but they don't criticize Obama for breaking his 2008 campaign promise and not advancing the minimum wage as he promised us during that first election. So it's the same old syndrome. It's a trap. It's what I call the least worst liberal trap. They lose all kinds of bargaining power. The Democratic leaders, once they get elected, never look back on them with any kind of respect or any kind of accommodation, even though they wouldn't be president without them.
That was citizen advocate, lawyer, and four-time independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Find more commentary and analysis on drone warfare by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Since late in 2012, a group known as Fix the Debt Campaign, led by private equity billionaire Pete Peterson, has advocated for deep cuts in the federal budget while protecting tax breaks for corporations and the rich. Among the targets of the $60 million campaign are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. While the objectives of the corporate-backed campaign have not yet succeeded, the group has exerted influence on the national debate, where congressional budget negotiations are focused on the Republican and conservative austerity agenda of slashing popular social safety net programs. Now a new report titled Fix the Debt CEOs Enjoy Taxpayer-Subsidized Pay, just released by the Institute for Policy Studies and the Campaign for America's Future, finds that Fix the Debt CEOs are pocketing massive taxpayer subsidies at the same time they're advocating deep cuts in government programs that benefit ordinary citizens. The report details how during the three-year period 2009 to 2011, the 90 publicly held corporate members of Fix the Debt paid their top CEOs $6.3 billion, of which taxpayers footed the bill through subsidies for $953 million to as much as $1.6 billion of these compensation packages. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Anderson, the report's co-author and IPS Global Economy Project Director. Here, Anderson explains why she believes Fix the Debt's members' conduct in taking massive taxpayer subsidies should undercut the credibility of their campaign, calling for deep budget cuts that demand sacrifice from average Americans.
Well, I should probably first explain what Fix the Debt is. So this is this corporate lobby group that came together last fall to try to influence the whole debate around the so-called fiscal cliff. And we took notice of them right away and saw that they needed a lot of scrutiny because they're a very heavily funded group. They said their initial budget was $60 million, and they've recruited big-name CEOs from large U.S. companies. And they project an image of patriotism and shared sacrifice. They're just really in this budget debate because they want to act responsibly and, you know, make sure our nation's economy is safe and sound. But when you look at the details of what they're actually promoting, it's, I think, quite disturbing, and that is they're pushing for cuts to Social Security and Medicare. And when you look at their tax proposals, they're all about getting more tax breaks for large corporations like the ones they run. And so we've done a series of studies scrutinizing Fix the Debt and who they are and what they're calling for. And this latest one looks at their executive pay practices and points out that ordinary taxpayers are actually subsidizing CEO pay at big companies like the ones that are leading this Fix the Debt campaign. And that's because companies can deduct an unlimited amount from their income taxes for executive pay as long as it's performance-based. So all of the stock options and performance bonuses and stuff that are shoveled, you know, into the pockets of these big CEOs are fully deductible. And, you know, it creates this perverse incentive. What it means is that the more these corporations pay their CEOs, the lower their tax burden. And that just contributes to our national debt.
Sarah, give us the overall picture of how these large corporations that are part of the Fix the Debt Coalition, wanting to suffocate a lot of other government programs, use tax loopholes and a lot of high-priced accountants to prevent the government from taxing CEO pay.
Yes. So under the U.S. tax code, you're only supposed to be able to deduct from corporate income taxes $1 million per executive for executive pay. Beyond that, it's considered not a reasonable business expense. The problem is there's this huge loophole, and that is you can deduct unlimited amounts as long as the pay is performance-based. And so when they made that tax reform, it opened the door for massive payouts of stock options and performance bonuses. Anything they could call performance-based then was fully deductible. And it's really part of the reason why we've seen this explosion of CEO pay in the past couple of decades. And the people in Fix the Debt are probably worse at taking advantage of this loophole than many other big Fortune 500 companies. But let me just give a couple of examples. The guy who got the most in performance pay that was fully deductible in the period we were looking at was the CEO of United Health Group. They're the biggest HMO in the country, and their CEO, Stephen Hemsley, took in about $194 million in performance pay during the years 2009 to 2011. And that works out to be about a $68 million tax break for United Health Group. And that is just for one individual CEO's pay. And so, you know, it is outrageous. And I think particularly because these guys are out there telling the rest of us that we need to tighten our belts, you know, we really need to cut back on earned benefit programs like Social Security and Medicare programs that many people rely on, you know, very heavily. And yet they haven't taken a look at the many ways that these corporations that they're running have been contributing to the deficit by taking advantage of these outrageous loopholes. If they were really serious about dealing with the deficit, I think they would be taking a look at this and calling for these loopholes to be closed.
As you look at fixing this loophole, what kinds of congressional action would be necessary to prevent these companies from having taxpayers subsidize what many would label as obscene CEO pay, right, by some of these major corporations?
Well, it's a very simple fix. As I mentioned, there is a cap on the deductibility of payments that companies make for executive compensation. It's set at $1 million, except there's this huge loophole for performance pay. And so if we got rid of that loophole, that would at least be one step towards ensuring that ordinary taxpayers are not subsidizing this runaway CEO pay. Congresswoman Barbara Lee has a bill on the House side that's even better than that. It would lower the cap to $500,000 and do away with the performance pay loophole. That's one reform that I think is just a total no-brainer. But you'd get much bigger numbers in terms of increased corporate revenues if you went after some of the other loopholes, like the ones that have been encouraging the use of tax havens. There you're talking about, you know, really mind-boggling amounts of money. I think something like, you know, $100 billion a year every year. That's another big front in the corporate tax reform that should be getting a lot more attention.
That was Sarah Anderson, Global Economy Project Director with the Institute for Policy Studies. You'll find a link to download a copy of the CEO Pay Report and related articles on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Economists and pundits tell us that the U.S. economy is slowly healing after the near collapse ushered in by the housing bubble bursting in 2007-2008. And while the unemployment rate was down a little in May to a four-year low of 7.5%, the real unemployment rate, which counts the underemployed and discouraged workers, is 13.8% of the workforce. The Great Recession exposed the unpleasant reality of many of the long-standing downward trends in the American economy, where the middle class is shrinking, income and wealth inequality are rising, and families are struggling to buy or keep their homes, pay health care bills, and afford college tuition. The ongoing partisan gridlock in Washington also reveals a political system where more often than not, those with the most money and power win elections and determine public policy, mostly benefiting the elite. The Occupy Wall Street movement, born in 2011, was an expression of this malaise, calling attention to a broken system urgently in need of repair. Into this bleak scene, where many citizens have come to believe that America's best days are behind us, Gar Alperovitz, professor of political economy at the University of Maryland, tells us there are many reasons to be hopeful. In his new book, What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution, Alperovitz examines innovative, democratic, and sustainable alternatives to America's current failing system. Your reporter spoke with Professor Alperovitz about new democratically owned enterprises that are thriving across the nation, such as worker-owned cooperatives, credit unions, public banks, and utilities.
The conditions of ever-deepening worry, pain, unemployment, inequality, ecological disaster, that's going on. Those are the deep trends. The fact is, however, they bring with them counter-trends. All great movements in history begin with the decay and the pain and the problems, but they also create consciousness and they create change and they begin to create reactions. And that's what I think we're seeing that the press doesn't either want to cover, and in many instances at the local level where the real action is, they no longer have staff able to cover what's going on. So we're seeing, and you know, the book What Then Must We Do is, in the first instance, it's a report on a lot of research done here at the Democracy Collaborative on growing numbers of worker co-ops, of public land trusts, of municipalization, of state bank efforts, of things that are developing. I think that we are indeed in a systemic crisis, and not simply a political crisis, and that it's creating the potential, and I certainly would not use the word inevitable, but the potential for something much, much more powerful as the pain sinks in and people realize that there's got to be a different direction.
Professor Alperovitz, your book tells us there are many signs of hope, as you've been saying. People are open to new ideas and pursuing innovation in better and fairer ways to organize their economy.
People don't realize there are something like 11 million people already involved in one or another form of worker-owned company in the United States. And that partly that's older forms that have developed over the years, and partly it's a whole new wave of new co-ops developing. That then out of this pain level and out of a hunger for something new, the new things are beginning. Or take another one. There are 130 million Americans involved in cooperatives in general, consumer cooperatives as well as producer cooperatives. If you take the credit unions, if you take them all together, they're bigger than one or two of the big banks in New York. These things have existed in the past, and they're an old kind of rediscovery, but they're also a whole new wave that are building on this. And notice the important thing about the worker-owned companies or the co-ops or the credit union. Credit union is a one-person, one-vote bank. All of that is a democratic way to own wealth. That is, one-person, one-vote co-ops or one-person, one-vote worker-owned companies or credit unions, one person, one vote, as opposed to the highly concentrated ownership of corporations where a mere 400 people have more wealth than the bottom 180 million. That's the kind of symbolic buildup we see in many parts of the economy just below the surface. Democratizing ownership at the neighborhood, the workplace, many things going on in cities and states we can talk about, plus some national crises that are pointing towards ever more interesting changes in healthcare and banking, big sectors. So there is, beneath the clouds, something is brewing that may have real power, and that's the way it usually is in when fundamental change is posed. It's not inevitable, certainly, but also it's not inevitable that the pain is going to go on for a long time with nobody reacting to it.
Well, a final question for you, Professor Alperovitz, and that is, in looking at the critical mass that
I'm sure you and many listeners would like to see reached in terms of really producing alternatives to our current workplace and economic system overall. What kinds of relationships should the major social justice movements have with this developing new cooperative movement to give it a push, to advocate for public policy changes that would provide technical support and financing to really push co-ops beyond where they currently are? As you said, it's kind of below the radar, but it's developing in an organic way. But what in your mind should be happening now to really push it to another level?
Again, it's not only co-ops. There's a whole range of things. That there's public banking. There's a whole big changes going to public health systems as well, at the local and the national level. You know, we're going to see these banking crises that happen again and again, and there's a whole set of ideas being developed at that level as well in the banking system. And the way to think about this is like the decades before the New Deal, where the state and local level in the so-called laboratories of democracy, people were working out how to do the things that became national programs later when the moment was right in the New Deal. This is the prehistory, I think, of the next possible fundamental transformation, building up these changes in democratic ownership. So I think that there are policy issues that could develop: technical assistance, training, research, finance, all of those, public procurement, purchasing from co-ops and worker-owned companies rather than from big corporations. There's a whole list of things that people are developing, many of which, again, are described in the book, that point towards a program. But I think the hard work has got to be developing in your own area. What excites me about this is everywhere you look under the radar of the normal press, you will find the ingredients of a long-term program. And as the pain levels develop, I think people are beginning to get serious about democratizing things in a way that could build for the future.
That was Garal Perovitz, the Lionel R. Bauman Professor of Political Economy at the University of Maryland and author of What Then Must We Do? Straight Talk About the Next American Revolution. For more information on the book and the future of worker and publicly owned enterprises, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.